take full responsibility for everything this government has been doing in tackling coronavirus, and I'm very proud of our record.
Tens of thousands of our citizens have died avoidably. These were unnecessary deaths because of systematic government misconduct.
With good British common sense, we will continue to defeat this virus and take this country forward.
There are a lot of green shoots of opportunity on the horizon. You know, we've been held down on the forest floor for far too long, and we will reach that canopy again.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg Westminster, your daily guide to British politics. I'm Sebastian Salek.
Yeah, very good afternoon. I'm Roger Hearing. Now, we begin with the virus, of course, because according to some senior scientists, the policy response in England isn't succeeding in controlling the disease spread. Infections are doubling every 9 days. An estimated 960,000 people are carrying the virus in England on any one day, and that's according to Imperial College. The stark study comes as Boris Johnson faces growing calls to impose another national lockdown, as of course has happened in France. Deaths and cases have been climbing across this country.
Yeah, certainly the trend in Europe as well. France and Germany both heading for lockdowns, the strictest measures since March for either country. But then also, you say there are those growing calls on Boris Johnson for another national lockdown. At the same time, you have the contrary voices, business leaders, campaigners, MPs, all urging the Prime Minister to resist a new lockdown. Among them is Julian Metcalfe, the founder of Pret and Itsu. He's leading that call, and that all makes the splash of today's Daily Mail. So lots of voices in the mix. No clear message for the Prime Minister. Joining us now to discuss all of this is John Nicholson. He is the SNP MP for Ochil and South Perthshire. John, I'm interested to look at this within the prism of what the SNP and what the government in Scotland is doing. We have a five-tier system coming in shortly in Scotland. Why is the government in Holyrood copying this model largely when, as we see from this report, as we see from the rising case numbers, it doesn't seem to be working?
Well, I think, as you point out, in Scotland, there's going to be a five-tier system. In England, there's a three-tier system. That was put into operation largely because a lot of people made the point that, for example, if you're living in the Outer Hebrides of Scotland and you have a very low COVID infection rate, it doesn't seem fair to businesses and people there that you should be abiding by exactly the same rules as the central belt, where there may be very different level of infection. So that's why it was put into place initially. And I think for people on the ground, it seems logical because people appreciate that different parts of the country have very different COVID infection levels. And one of the challenges for politicians, I think, is for people to be compliant with the rules. They've got to understand what they are. They've got to make sense. It's got to be clear to them what they are and what it's actually delivering on the ground. And in Scotland, I think so far, people seem to be largely compliant and trusting of what their political leaders are saying because they know the politicians are listening to the scientists.
But John, I mean, people are clearly confused in Scotland. Five tiers seems quite hard to follow. Edinburgh Evening News has been talking about many of its readers writing in saying, where on earth am I? What does it mean? I mean, this is something, in order to get compliance, it has to be simple, doesn't it?
Well, I think it is relatively simple. If you're in an area of the country which is high COVID rates, you're subject to greater restrictions than an area of the country where you're not. I think people find that perfectly possible to understand. The First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, has been taking daily press briefings. She's been leading them herself, and she's always had the Chief Nursing Officer or the Chief Medical Officer or the Health Secretary beside her. And she's answered every conceivable question she's been asked. There is a high level of trust, I think, for her and what she's saying. In fact, a recent poll showed that voters in England trust Nicola Sturgeon on COVID more than they trust the Prime Minister of the UK, Boris Johnson.
I mean, what about the circuit breaker that's in place at the moment in Scotland? The number of new cases, though, consistently high. I mean, I'm just looking at them and they seem to be, if not around the 1,000 mark, above that level. Is it not worth continuing that? It's due to end on Monday. It feels a little bit premature with things as they are.
Well, I think that's being reviewed on a daily basis. And, you know, I'm a journalist by profession. And until I entered politics That's what I did. And so I believe in evidence-based policy making. So I think ultimately what the politicians have to do always is listen to the scientists. I'm not a scientist. I've got zero science training. My degree's in English and history. So I would approach this in the same way as I'd approach a story as a journalist, which is you go to the top experts in the country, you listen to what they say, you review what they say, you listen to competing claims, and then you make decisions.
But they don't agree. That's the problem, isn't it, John? I mean, we can find six or seven, we've had them on the programme, who would have very contrary views. In the end, it's the kind of science you follow, not just follow the science.
Well, that sounds slightly Trumpist. I think ultimately the broad consensus of scientific opinion, it tends to be relatively clear. Let me give you an example of where I think there was confusion south of the border in England. In the course of the summer, Boris Johnson told people to go back to work. But at the same time, he was telling people to continue to socially distance. Now, there's an inherent contradiction in that, because for most people, going back to work means travelling in crowded public transport. And we saw the pictures from the London Tube. People were crammed in to very busy underground carriages in a way that was not compliant with social distancing. But it was impossible to socially distance under those circumstances. And yet the Prime Minister seemed to be oblivious to this and kept telling people to go back to work. And what I discovered from my post bag as a Member of Parliament was people saying to me, I don't feel safe going back to work because I don't think my employer has put proper safety measures in play. Especially disabled people or people with underlying health conditions felt very nervous about this. But because Boris Johnson was telling people to go back to work, they felt subsequently pressurized by their employers. Now, that's the kind of confusing messaging, I think, that was very damaging for public engagement with the rules that were being set by political leaders at 10 Downing Street. It was different in Scotland, as you say.
Yeah, and you're seeking to streamline that with these five tiers coming in. I mean, again, we have the benefit of hindsight here in that England's done it. They also ran into a bit of trouble, as we know, with the local leaders in Manchester and the like. Nicola Sturgeon announcing the levels of restrictions for each of Scotland's 32 local council areas today. How is she going to ensure that these sorts of conflicts between local and national government in Scotland are avoided?
Well, that's a very good question. I think one of the problems in the general election was that the Prime Minister topped up expectations so high when it came to the north of England. And he said that he was going to level up, didn't he? And he said that the north of England would find itself on a steep economic trajectory, which would give it much more parity with the south of England. And I think, as we've seen in multiple occasions, from the Brexit vote to the current rammy that there's been between political leaders in the north and south of England, I think we've seen how much distrust there is in the north of England for their political leaders. I think one of the big mistakes the people in the north of England made was not to embrace the opportunity to have devolution when they were offered it. If you remember, there were referenda under the Blair government, and people in the north of England voted against having their own regional assemblies. I suspect if the vote was to be held today, they would vote very differently. Scotland, of course, although it's quite a large country geographically, it is a much smaller population. It's it's only 5.5 million. Or so, and England is 11 or 12 times that. So to that extent, it is easier, of course, in population terms, to set rules, because you're not dealing with such huge numbers of population. In the north of Scotland, for example, the population is relatively low, artificially low for historical reasons. So it's a very different set of circumstances.
Now, John, what about Christmas? I mean, you probably heard the a plea by the Lib Dems and the Alliance Party Northern Ireland for all the nations of the UK to try and coordinate what they're going to do. We had Willie Rennie, a leader of the Lib Dems in Scotland, in fact, on the programme yesterday, backing that call. Doesn't it make sense?
No, it doesn't make sense at all. We're in October. It's October. Christmas is a couple of months away. We have no idea what circumstances will be like 8 weeks from now. It makes no sense at all to make a plan based on circumstances which are unfolding on an almost daily level. And Willie Rennie's argument, in as much as I can understand it, is that because you won't be able to control or stop people travelling vast distances, you've got to succumb to what they will do, and you've got to tell them that it's okay to do what you don't really think that they should be doing in the first place. All the scientific evidence is that folks should not be travelling hundreds of miles from one high COVID area to the next.
The counter-argument to that, John,
that's a sensible idea.
John, the counter-argument to that would be that if you start to impose these rules, you stop people seeing their loved ones for Christmas, they're going to do it anyway, and then that social contract, which all of this relies on, breaks down for good.
Yes, but at the start of this whole ghastly pandemic, a lot of folk were warning that people would not be compliant. But what we've seen is that although there obviously are problems, and you know we know parties and breaking up parties, we've all read the stories, but by and large people understand what they have to do to keep themselves and their families safe. It doesn't make sense to say to people in October, although we think it's dangerous to travel and although we're telling you not to travel, on this one day we're going to allow you, may yep. encourage you to travel hundreds of miles. It's a very foolish thing to say.
Let's have a look at what else is making news in the world of politics, and we start with the thing that Labour has been waiting for, Roger, for a little while.
Yes, it's that big anti-Semitism report. You may remember, of course, that allegations of anti-Semitism in Labour under Jeremy Corbyn were passed to the Equality and Human Rights Commission. Well, that report has now come back, and it's found the party was responsible for, quotes, unlawful acts of harassment and discrimination. It identified serious failings in the party leadership in addressing the issue. It also said the party had, quote, inadequate processes for handling complaints. The watchdog has now given the party an unlawful act notice, meaning it has to publish an action plan within 6 weeks. We're going to hear, I think, from Keir Starmer later in the day with his response to that.
Yes, and that, of course, falls on him to see through. Interesting, the line about inadequate processes isn't exactly a direct attack on Corbyn and his administration. They would argue that the Labour Compliance Unit was perhaps not as its most efficient when Ian McNichol was in place as General Secretary, not a huge ally of Corbyn, but then when Jenny Formby came in, the process became a lot better. So not perhaps an attack on Corbyn, that one, although more of a statement on the state of the party and its way of dealing with these complaints. And then we've got Brexit talks. Negotiators heading back to Brussels today. They've been going on in London, haven't they, for a little while now. Signs of progress in some of the big issues. No big breakthrough yet, though. You'd know about it if it had happened. Bloomberg sources saying there's even hope an agreement could be reached early next month. And we're told that the two sides are close to some agreement on state aid and how any agreement there would be enforced. Fishing, though, seems still to be up in the air.
Yes, I think that's definitely the big one. Meanwhile, The Guardian is reporting that up to 10% of England's population could be tested for coronavirus every week. This comes after the government officials asked local health officers to deploy 30-minute saliva kits in an acceleration of Boris Johnson's Operation Moonshot mass screening plan. That's a rather controversial one. According to a letter from NHS Test and Trace seen by The Guardian, this could all happen soon. If delivered, it could result in a huge increase in national testing, up to 5 million tests weekly from the current rate of about 300,000.
I've got to say, I'm surprised by this. When I thought Operation Moonshot was dead and buried, and I thought the Prime Minister alluded to the fact himself, but I'll believe it when I see it. This testing level, it seems like one of the only ways to get society up and running again before we get some sort of a vaccine. So I think we're all crossing our fingers for this one, but it is a case of wait and see. And then the Times has this story of a German vaccine that's been backed by Pfizer, could be ready to distribute in the UK before Christmas. Christmas could come early, you might say. Senior government sources saying the verdict on whether this vaccine works is going to come before the competing offer from Oxford and AstraZeneca. So the Pfizer boss, Albert Bourla, claims it's in the last mile and we'll know for sure within weeks. If approved, it goes without saying the vaccine will go to the elderly and the vulnerable first. You've got that priority, and then everyone else well into the next year before they see any dose from a vaccine that could help solve all of this.
Well, believe it when you see it, I think is the answer there. Right, let's go to our guest for the rest of this programme, Alex Dean, Head of UK Public Affairs FTI Consulting. Alex, of course, your background is very much in the Conservative Party, but let me kick off by asking you about the anti-Semitism report that's landed now for Labour. I mean, this was an issue that was very long-running and really an absolute albatross round the neck of the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn. Do you think this will have dealt with it in the end?
Morning, Roger. Morning, Seb. I'm not sure it will have done, because the question and challenge will now be, what are you going to do about it, Keir Starmer? If you are the leader of the party now, and you have responsibility not only for the processes that were apparently wrong, but for the standing of your party, are you going to discipline Jeremy Corbyn? Do you expect him to leave your ranks? And that's incredibly difficult for Starmer to deal with. So much of his grassroots membership, so much of the momentum-inspired membership that has swelled Labour to be our largest political party by membership, are much more fans of Corbyn than they are of Starmer. So I actually think it's not hugely... it's not something that Starmer would particularly have wished for. Of course, in conventional terms, no one wishes for their party to be called anti-Semitic anyway. But in some ways, he will be pleased to see a dagger through the heart of the Ancien Régime that he was so plainly at odds with. On the other hand, it gives him a very big challenge, and I was going to say albatross around the neck on this, gives a big challenge about what he does about it.
Certainly an issue for Keir Starmer to make some quite definitive decisions on. What about the state of the Conservative Party? I mean, we're hearing so much about various factions within the party putting various pressures on Boris Johnson. What is your sense of where he goes next with all of that in mind?
Certainly no sense of a leadership challenge or anything like that. So there's not factions in that sense. But it's definitely true that there are differences of perspective in the Conservative Party about what to do next on lockdown. And I think that that is a big division between those who would have us adopt a position much more akin or similar to the Swedish approach and those who want to, you know, carry on and have one more heave and have another lockdown and, inverted commas, follow the science. That is definitely quite a significant political divide. And there are a couple of others too. The approach that the leadership took on Huawei before it reversed its position betokens, I think, broader questions about what we do with infrastructure and what we do with admission of other people's finance and investment into things like our 5G infrastructure, which I think is fascinating about how a country views itself and what we're going to do vis-a-vis permissions for international investment when we are fully outside of the EU and outside of the transition period. And then where I think the party is much more united than it would once have been is on questions like Brexit, where not only are we all leavers now, and it's, you know, 4 years after we voted for leave, but I think that the party, certainly in Westminster, is very much behind the Prime Minister and behind his team seeking to resolve the negotiation in a way that, frankly, it wasn't behind Theresa May and her negotiation team. So much more unity on that one.
But Alex, in a way, Brexit almost beside the point. But interestingly, the overlap between members of the European Research Group, which of course was, I suppose, the albatross around the neck of David Cameron and Theresa May afterwards, does overlap very much with the Northern Research Group, which is this group of MPs who are causing problems for Boris Johnson. Is there a sense that perhaps that section of the party, whatever it represents, is also not being served by the current administration?
I don't think any... I mean, fair question, and I'm a very Eurosceptic myself and would probably be lumped into that group, but I wouldn't say that I feel like that. And I don't think most do when you look at a government that is about to resolve Brexit, which was the main kind of motivator behind a lot of that ERG-type perspective, and a government that has Dominic Raab, a, you know, profound Eurosceptic and someone who'd be seen as a kind of leader in that environment as Foreign Secretary. So I'm not, and of course Boris Johnson himself is a big Eurosceptic, so I wouldn't say that people feel ill-served about that. There is another part of challenge for the leadership that we haven't touched on, which is implied by your Northern Research Group point. The sense in which the so-called red wall seats are being a focus of government activity and a focus of lockdown activity. And If you want to hang on to your majority, which of course plainly the Conservative Party does, then you've got to think about the needs of the MPs in those seats and how the Conservative Party is perceived in them. That is a big challenge. And there, I think we're seeing the 2019 intake being a great deal more assertive and more confident in itself than most new batches of new BMPs are, where the tradition might be to keep your head down and toe the party line. That is not the 2019 intake perspective.
Yeah, I mean, they're absolutely caught between trying to keep their seats and to impress and to satisfy their constituencies, but also toe the party line to an extent. Are they getting enough from Boris Johnson in terms of support? I mean, we saw that huge row play out, for example, in Manchester, and there were lots of very vocal Conservative Greater Manchester MPs having to call out the government there for not getting enough for their constituents.
Yeah, I think 2021 will be the year that determines that. I think right now, plainly, government's doing all that it can. You may disagree with the approach that the government's taking on things, but I think plainly government is seeking to do all it can in the face of a terrible challenge from coronavirus and is making hard decisions, which is easy for, you know, all of us as backseat epidemiologists to kind of second guess, but it's pretty difficult. I think once we get into 2021 and we're beyond this, will we be locked down at Christmas and what's going to happen with seats and restrictions and potential coronavirus compensation in the next week or two. We get into the next year past Christmas and we have the long vista of a year's economic activity, and is it going to be more of the same or are we going to have something different? Then I think we'll know much better how people in those environments are going to feel about their MPs. Right now, for me, it feels very knee-jerk and immediate, and it doesn't feel like it's going to be the kind of thing that determines long-term whether you say the government was good for us in the Red Wall seats or not.
Well, let me, if I may, Alex, and briefly mention something else. It's a Conservative and Unionist party, and the union bit, frankly, does seem to be strained. Is Boris Johnson the man who could lose Scotland, do you think?
I don't think so, but I definitely think that he would hate it. I think that, for example, I think that the Prime Minister fears a no-deal Brexit a great deal less than he fears attacks on the union. Now, let's not forget that ultimately, it's up to Westminster whether we have a referendum north of the border or not. But that's the legal and letter of the law point. It's not the political point. And I think it'll be very difficult to resist the case for another referendum if the SNP achieves a victory in the forthcoming elections north of the border in the kind of numbers that we're seeing projected right now. But, Roger, I do think that some things would have to be discussed and agreed before any such thing could take place. First of all, the nigh on million Scots who live in England, who were disenfranchised at the last poll, I think they would have to be able to vote, given that, you know, nations are people as well as places.
Bloomberg Westminster. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.